Today's episode is episode 223, and today's episode is called Surrealism. Today's episode is on the Surrealist art movement. It's inspired by the Surrealist art movement. It's quite a large field to try and dissect and analyze, so I'm just going to describe some of it, talk about some things I'm thinking about as a result of reading Surrealism, and just kind of dive into it here. So the origins of Surrealism, it seemed to be active between the years of 1924 right up until 1966. But while I was looking into it, it seemed to be around the outbreak of World War II, the start of World War II, where things started to disband. André Breton was the figurehead, the spearhead of Surrealism. Before Surrealism, there was a movement called Dadaism, which seemed to be more prevalent around World War I period. So what I got from reading about Surrealism was it came from the desire to explore the unconscious, explore the irrational. I think André Breton, he was a medic during World War I, so he would have experienced the trauma that was World War I. So I think that got him and people at that time questioning the role society played in getting society to a place where war erupts. So from my research, from looking at it, it seemed to be that they were seeing that a society which is suffocated by rationality, it can pave the way towards conflict. And the hope, from what I see with movements like Surrealism or Dadaism, was to question rationality itself and to explore the irrational. So it was actually Sigmund Freud was an inspiration, one of the figures that inspired the Surrealist movement. It was his work in psychoanalysis. I think where they diverged, though, was the Surrealists were more, they were more concerned with, or more interested in, the creativity that can come about from exploring the unconscious. Whereas a psychoanalyst like Freud was possibly more interested in the curative powers of exploring the unconscious with the intent of helping people through psychoanalysis, whereas with the Surrealists and with these art movements, their primary concern was more centered around creativity. But when you think about it, from my own experience, I think like creativity, a byproduct of that can be healing, can be curative. But it isn't the primary focus, so they can go about exploring the unconscious purely because it's a source of new ideas. So they develop techniques like automatism, which is just free flow of thought, writing out whatever comes to your mind. It's practicing unfiltered writing. That was one of the techniques they developed, which comes about from this desire to be creative, to find creativity from this. But then when you think about psychoanalysis, they would have had free association, which seems quite similar to what automatism is. It's like freely speaking, and then you're kind of making links and associations between what you're saying. Another thing that kind of occurred to me, though, when I was reading into this, and it's related to what I was talking about in the previous episode about Freud and Jung diverging, was that Freud didn't back Surrealism. I know that, well, from what I was reading, André Breton would have sent a letter to Freud, and he was interested in getting Freud's attention, I guess, getting his backing behind what they're doing, or just, I suppose, for at least for him to be aware of what they're doing. But Freud didn't seem to reciprocate the respect. He didn't seem to understand Surrealism. And it got me thinking about what I was talking about with Freud and Jung diverging over the more spiritual element of psychology. because this, I don't think this is verbatim, but this is the essence of what Freud wrote back to Breton after he sent him a letter. He said, "I am not able to clarify for myself what surrealism is and what it wants. Perhaps I am not destined to understand it. I who am so distant from art." So that got me thinking about it would have actually been contradictory to that split with Jung if he did understand what surrealism was, because I suppose when you delve into the world of art, personally I feel like you're delving into spirituality, and that's what that conflict with Jung seemed to have been about, this unwillingness to go into the spiritual realm for fear of not being taken seriously, that he wanted to establish psychology as a hard science that would be respected and taken seriously. But this did get me to think about perhaps there was an authenticity in him that he didn't actually see the relevance of spirituality. Maybe it wasn't the fear. It's hard to say. But maybe he genuinely didn't see the relevance of incorporating some sort of understanding of spirituality in psychology, in the same sense that he didn't see what art was about. Maybe he just wasn't destined, maybe he wasn't built to see that. That's not to say he's right or wrong, because the thing is, art can be right or wrong too, but maybe he just genuinely didn't feel a connection to that, maybe, and as a result he didn't really understand it. I wasn't willing to understand it. I don't know. It got me to think about maybe it wasn't an unwillingness to understand it. Maybe just he didn't see it. He didn't see what the connection. So that's the origins of surrealism. So it started, from what I could see, it was a need to question rationality in the hope that potentially it can help avoid conflicts in the future, which when you look at history, it didn't actually manage to do that, because World War II came about regardless. But it's just hard to say what the impact was, positive or negative, because the thing is, today I'm talking about surrealism in 2023. And it's helped me to reconcile some of the things I've been thinking and feeling about, and without it, I might find it more difficult to express what I want to express. So it's kind of like life can have a habit of being circular. So potentially where we're at right now as a society and a civilization, there's ways of thinking that we need to help us move forward that can be found from people who have already maybe progressed further in our thinking than we have today. Which, that sounds quite odd, because you would assume that with each generation that we're building on the thoughts of the generation before. So there shouldn't be any need for circularity there. We shouldn't need to go back to a person in the past. And it sounds odd that a person in the past might have elaborated on a line of inquiry more thoroughly and deeper than us today. That's an interesting thing to fathom. But I think the things they're questioning here in surrealism is relevant to today, because for me, surrealism is questioning the nature of reality, which leads you into questioning human consciousness. And in today's day and age, I feel that's a very relevant question. It probably always is, but I think it's pertinent, because with the evolution of AI, I think we need to start asking more questions around what is AI? Is it conscious? How do we know if something is conscious? And in order to do that properly, I think we need to be questioning human consciousness at a serious level as well. So it's I guess you look back in the past, because there's people, when you think about it, they had a different environment. And you can assume that the environment today is superior to the past because technologically it looks more evolved. But when you look at our era today, there's so much things built into it that are distracting us, which on a mind level I feel makes us weaker because we've got these attention spans that are possibly inferior to people in the past who didn't have these distractions to the same extent we have today. Obviously they have different pros and cons in their context, but maybe they'd a bit more space to elaborate on thoughts. And then the other thing is the culture of the day and age. So I don't know what the culture was like back in 1920s, 1930s, but I have a feel for the culture of where I'm at today. And I would say that the culture of where I'm at today, there isn't an awful lot of room for depth of thought that is needed to question human consciousness, to question these topics that there's no definitive answers to, but they need to be pondered and taken to heart. And it's something that human beings can do, and I think it's something that helps evolve people and societies. So the explorations of the unconscious is a big thing from what I can see in the surrealism movement. That's why I found it so interesting, so fascinating. Like even the word itself, surrealism, so sewer, this is my own kind of breaking up with the word, but sewer is a French word for above or on, sur la table, on the table, on the table. So it's it got me thinking about like surrealism. So if you think of sewer as, so usually in French it's on the table, but I'm going to use it as above. So if above reality, so it's questioning the things that are formless, but they're what goes into reality. They're it's what reality is made of in the tangible form. So I like pondering that. And André Breton, what I liked about this movement too is it's an art movement that began with writers. So it was Breton and people like him that laid the foundations, from what I can see anyway, laid the foundations for other artists then over time to join the movement in their own way. Like Salvador Dali was a person, from what I was reading, that needed a movement similar to this to create the culture necessary for a Dali-like person to evolve. So it helps highlight the importance of establishing a culture, how important that is for future artists to have the environment where it stimulates their mind enough to become the artist they can potentially become. So that's what I liked about this. It's like this movement began with writers. Their thoughts and ideas helped to influence then other artists that might be of a different kind, that they might be more interested in other modalities of like painting and drawing or even sculpting. So André Breton, the other book, I haven't fully read it. I've read bits of it. Nadia is one of the more popular books that Breton wrote, and it's a challenging read, and it's a little bit different, but it does, like that the character Nadia. So Nadia, I think, is the Russian word for hope, but it's the beginning of the Russian word for hope. It's not the full word. And Nadia seems to be quite a complex character, and in many ways she kind of embodied surrealism for Breton, in the sense that she's based on a real person he met, as far as what I can see, and she ended up being committed to like a mental asylum. But I think what inspired Breton about her, she had a very unique way of seeing things. And so that got me to think about and question the way we treat people who have a different perception in life, the way we can alienate them by making them feel wrong for how they see things. So that's it's a very delicate line, because so I haven't fully read this book, so I'm kind of basing it off of my own. What I'm going to say next is based off of my own kind of experience or thoughts as well as this book. But I think that Breton would have drawn beauty from encountering someone who has it's kind of a free spirit, sees life in a different way to those around them. But what I feel is needed to help that person is a grounding in themselves. So I feel it's very difficult to live in a world where you see things in a different way to maybe the people around you in your immediate environment, and you're feeling wrong for seeing things differently. So basically, I think what's needed is it's an amalgamation of allowing yourself to see the world as you see it, and being grounded in yourself, having trust in yourself. And I think that becomes easier when people form a culture where that's understood, where that's respected. So another technique that surrealism would use is juxtaposition. So they would have an objects that don't, on the surface, don't go together. Like there was an object that I saw with like a lobster on a telephone. I don't know whether that was a Dali thing, but or maybe it was Rene Marguerite, maybe. But it's objects that it's quite jarring to look at, that they don't go together. And on a thought level, two things that on the surface don't seem to go together for me anyway, from what I can see, is the analytical person and the mindful person. So the intellectual and the kind of monk, the monk, pretty much. They seem to be quite contradictory, because to be in the moment, to be present, it's a state where you're not thinking a lot, where there's a sense of you're present, you're feeling connected to your surroundings, to the external reality. That's even a technique of when you're in your head too much, it's like breathe and focus on just even the sensation of touching the desk in front of you, or just observing your surroundings. So that's kind of the Zen mind. But then you've got the analytical, intellectual mind, which can become all-consuming. I suppose I speak from my own experience. It's like when you're working out things in your head, when you're thinking about something, and then you suddenly see something in a different way. For me, there's a kind of a there's a thrill to that. Well, it's not like a thrill in the sense of very exciting or anything. There's something satisfying about thinking on something. There's hard work to that, and then eventually seeing something a different way. Or you're taking in a lot of information, and your goal is to express it in the simplest way possible, and that requires taking in quite a bit of information and letting your mind ponder it. And eventually you like, from that kind of hard work and effort, you're gradually reaching your goal. Like, things do become more simplified in your mind around that specific thing you've been focusing on, until you focus on another thing again. It's a continuous kind of process. But those things for me are quite juxtaposed. The Zen present person and the person who is intellectual, they get a satisfaction from that. They don't on the surface seem to go together, but what I would argue is that they do go together, they complement each other. But it requires a culture to normalize that. Because I think they're so contradictory that the only way for you to see they can coexist is experientially. Like, I'm only speaking from my own experience. That's the only way that I've started to see over the years that these two states, these two ways of being, can coexist. Like, it's imperfect. Like, sometimes you'll find yourself thinking too much, and other times you'll find yourself being a bit too docile or a bit too laid back, not trying to force things when you should be maybe trying to get some momentum. So it's not a perfect match, but they do complement each other. So I feel to like ponder the big questions of life, you need the Zen mind. If you don't have that, you'll drive yourself fucking mad. But then to actually have detail, where you're not actually a fucking charlatan, just parroting words, that requires a sharp intellect, from what I can see. You need to take in information, critically analyze it, and like that's how you find your own way of expressing things, your own vocabulary, so you're not like just a parrot, just parroting things. You're not like an ideologue so much, because you're like putting the time into critically think through things. So you need both, and that's wrapped around the culture you create. Because I think it's possible for people, maybe not all people, but there's certain people where that is possible, but they need to experience it, I think, more so than somebody telling them this can be possible. Because it's just, for me, it's just so different, those two states of being, that the only way to realize they exist within a person is to experience it. So I've already gone through some of the surrealist techniques there. Dislocation is another technique that they had. So that's putting a familiar object next to an unfamiliar setting. Like I mentioned, the lobster on the telephone. And then the juxtaposition is various unrelated elements or fragments are placed side by side or one atop the other. The aim is to create an interesting effect of comparison or contrast. So I think that ties into therapy as well. What you'll find through therapy, through more following therapeutic modalities, is that oftentimes you understand one state of being in contrast to another. So you understand what a healthy relationship feels like in contrast to an unhealthy one. I think the contrast is needed to really help you understand understand what both feels like. It's the contrast that kind of accentuates that. And then transformation was another one. That's actually quite an interesting effect. I think René Magritte, there's some images where he uses transformation. So this is objects changing into something new related to the surface and shape. Disappears to be a person, but on closer inspection, it's a bunch of flowers. Or that's also kind of like the... it escapes me now, but yeah, it's like looking at an image. It can be a rabbit or a duck, depending on how you look at it. There's another psychological modality. It's not coming to mind for me right now. Is it Gestalt? Gestalt therapy, maybe? Let me just quickly Google that. Gestalt. Might not be Gestalt. But anyway, it's you've seen the picture before. It's an image that it could be... I've even seen one too, an old woman or a young lady. Same image, it's just depending on how you look at it. Oftentimes it's like, it's black and white imagery. So if you focus on the white, you see one image. If you focus on the black, you actually see another image. It's quite trippy, to be honest. And it makes you kind of think about your perception in everyday life, how you can take it for granted, these things. And then at one point as well, it alluded to the thinking behind the art. So surrealism seems to incorporate many different styles. So the emphasis becomes more on the thinking than the styles themselves. I think Dadaism was using a similar approach because there's just so many... So like with Dadaism, for example, which is another art movement that came prior to Surrealism, because they were, it was really kind of out there. I think even one thing was, they had a toilet in an art gallery. This place random objects in there. And so when you're looking at it, you realize this person just placed an object in an art gallery. So how was that art? They haven't made the object, they've just placed it in there. So if you're contemplating that, obviously you might have some people that are just pretentious and they throw stuff in there and there is no thought behind it. There's genuinely no real thought behind it. It's just a mimic of something else. But it's just, say, just put that aside. Let's just say this is a true artist in the sense that this is somebody with like a substance to their character. Then if they place an object in an art gallery that they haven't created themselves, you have to start thinking about like what were they thinking? What are they trying to get at here? And so here, for example, it gets you to think, it gets you to contemplate what's going through their head. What way are they seeing things? What are they trying to make us question? Like, what are the basic things that we are taking for granted that them doing what they're doing is trying to make us question that and see that in our own lives? So that's the many styles allude to the thinking behind it. So when there's many different styles, I think it helps you to focus more on the thought process behind it then. It's kind of like in a foreign language, there's so many words there. There's an unlimited amount of words. There's so many different variations, permutations of the language that you have to, if you want to learn it, you put in a bit of time into thinking about how is the language structured. There's certain things you start asking yourself then. It's just like, that, and that stems from this overwhelm. There's too much information to take in. So I have to start looking at the thought process behind it. So that's what I think with this art here. It's like the so many different ways of expressing surrealist artwork that it would take too long to try and analyze everything on a surface level. So it gets you to think a little bit deeper in the sense to ask basic assumptions here. What are some of the basic assumptions they're questioning here? So I think, yeah, a big one with that is, and was like, what even is art? I think they were disillusioned by the bourgeois. I suppose, how art can become commodified. And I think their movement was like really questioning, what the hell is art? What's the purpose of it? It was kind of an anti-art way of, yeah, they made you question art in an anti-art way. I think that was some of what they were doing. So yeah, the last point I want to talk about is around the modern day. So I was listening to some interviews with Grimes. I hadn't actually come across her before. She's a very interesting woman. And I had written down a quote from her here on the Lex Fridman podcast, so I'm just going to read out some of it. So she's talking about authenticity in art. She made a very good point here. So she said, I used to be really mad when I realized that people didn't write their music. And I would be like, that's fake. And then I realized that there is all this weird bitterness and aggroness about authenticity in art. But I had this weird realization recently where I started thinking that art is sort of a decentralized collective thing. Art is kind of a conversation with all the artists that have ever lived before you. It's not like anyone is reinventing the wheel here. You're kind of just taking thousands of years of art and running it through your own little algorithm and making your interpretation of it. So I like that, because ultimately, because of the unlimited nature of questioning all this stuff, when you look at it from a point of view of being in conversations with people of a similar mind, it makes it more like an endeavor you would want to be involved in. Perhaps this again connects to creating a culture where conversations could come about that strengthen that culture. So what I think she's touching at there, it mightn't be overtly her intention of what she's talking about here, but the sense I get from it is it's about having a conversation. It's about having a conversation about art here, for instance, but it's about having a conversation about the things that matter to you, things that are on your mind, things you want to express. I suppose just even brainstorming with people around ideas, because ultimately this is the building blocks for what you're going to create in the world. And even for this podcast, it helps me a lot when I've got people in my life I can have conversations with. Even recently, I had a conversation with someone and it got me thinking about how monotheism mightn't have been a step towards enlightenment in the way that as a society, I think we assume it to be. I even see it in where I am today. People will often refer to another person as a pagan. It's a derogatory thing. I rarely see somebody refer to a person as a pagan as a positive thing. Obviously, it depends on the person you're meeting. But me having a conversation with someone just about random stuff got me to talk about that in that conversation, and then it got me to think about why not maybe do a podcast episode around that. Why don't I ponder that a bit more? Because my whole kind of point around that was, if you look at religion as a philosophy, and if you look at true symbolism, I think you get more at the heart of the religion and the spiritual truths that are there. And so that for me is more accessible when you look at religion. When you take a religion, for example, like Buddhism, where they have many gods, and the gods are also sometimes a combination between like an elephant and a man. So you can't, like, that doesn't exist in the real world. So it makes you view religion as symbolism. So it's not something you use literally. Because for me, like, that's more of an evolved state in a person, that they can look at things both symbolically and literally. It's like if you look at everything literally, it's like you're just, it's that proverbial, you've got a hammer and you try and use that on everything. You see everything as a nail. And that's not the case in life. So for me, a more evolved state of mind is the capacity to look at things through symbols and literal in the world as well. So in that sense, I feel like monotheism was a step away from that in terms of society at large, because it got us to view it more literally. So you think of one god, a man, or not, it doesn't even matter if it's a man, it gets us thinking of one thing that is human-like, that is judging us. So I think that was a step away from what I would consider our like more spiritual truths to life that transcend the material world. Because ultimately, that I think, if you're going to have religion in your life, I feel like the purpose of it is to have something that brings you a certain amount of peace and calmness, serenity in the tough times in your life. And for me, it's something that needs to transcend the material world of problems, because that's where your problems exist right now. So like for me, that's the purpose of having a religion or philosophy or something. It gets you through the tough times in life. But that's my own personal view on it, and I might do an episode around that. But my point there, and there was just like that idea and just that trail of thought, I didn't really know that was in me until I had a conversation with somebody else, and then it just came out. And I was like, so this all boils down to the kind of the culture you create, and it starts with you. Like, there's no point in looking around you and saying, oh, people aren't interested in what I'm interested in, they're not, it doesn't seem like they're welcoming of my ideas and stuff. Like, life is tough, it's hard, but you'll figure it out. Find outlets to express things if you need to express them. Ultimately, there is no right or wrong way to live your life. It's just like, what sits well with you. Just for me, my compass in life is just a sense that I'm kind of, that there's some bit of integrity in me, and that's only something, like, I suppose when I'm talking about the integrity in me, that's regard, that's like other people's perceptions of me or their opinions of me are not taken into consideration in that integrity. That's something I feel in me, because life is complex. We're complex people. The thing is, you don't know. Also, there's always going to be some problems. There's always going to be some things in your character that you're not fully happy with, or you're not even fully sure about. You don't fully understand. And that's not to say that that's not just part of life. That's part of what you're here to figure out. I don't think anybody's life is rosy completely and they have no problems at all. And if they don't have any problems, oftentimes it's just they're in denial that there's no problems in their life right now. And again, problems aren't even a bad thing necessarily if you've got an attitude that you are interested in trying to solve them. And also, your problems, sometimes when you share them honestly with people, that's where connection comes from. That for me is a healthy form of bonding with other people, especially if they're willing to reciprocate, if they're sharing some of their problems with you. It's something that kind of comes about naturally, I think. And one thing to sense out there too, though, is that there's a culture of you're sharing your problems to shed light on them, to resolve them, to work through them. You're not dumping them on people. Like that's also built into the culture, and that all starts with you. And that's the surrealist episode. That's the main things I wanted to cover. There's some of the things I've been thinking about. There's some of the things I wanted to cover. So that's it, and I'll speak to you on the next episode.